This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Thank you for downloading this programme from the BBC. In this edition of The Report, Simon Cox travels to Nepal, recently devastated by earthquakes, to investigate what will happen to the foreign aid flowing into the country.
There's just been another tremor. We were just in a hotel sitting underneath a canopy. We ran outside and people were really scared because they were wondering, was this another big one? And the tremor went on for a good 20 or 30 seconds and it was incredibly strange and scary. You could just feel the ground underneath you shifting and swaying.
It was actually an earthquake, the second to hit Nepal in as many weeks. I'd arrived days earlier, alerted by worried charities to a plan to channel all of the earthquake relief donations into a special disaster fund controlled by Nepal's government. Local charities feared it would end up wasted or siphoned off.
The whole country runs on corruption and kickbacks. It's like a system that is so entrenched. Unless you have leaders, you know, I don't think it's going to be over in the coming years.
I wanted to follow the money, to see what's been happening to the vast amount of aid already pumped into Nepal and what could happen to the billions that will flow in to rebuild the country. To understand the devastation the earthquakes have caused, you have to get out of the capital into the lush green Kathmandu Valley, where farmers live in mud and brick houses.
So we've just pulled over at a village. It's only about 15 minutes from Kathmandu, and this place looks like it's been shelled. Lots of the houses totally collapsed, and even the ones that are still standing, I'm next to one, the whole of the back wall has been sheared off, and there's just a pile of rubble there. 15 houses are uninhabitable.
Most of the buildings in this area have damaged. You can see the other building as well that also has a crack.
This one here
this
as well.
One also. So these are quite vulnerable buildings.
You can probably just hear behind me they're actually levelling the ground and just chopping away at some bamboo trying to make a temporary shelter. And there are many villages further out in rural Nepal that are going to be even worse off than here. And what this tells you is about the scale of the reconstruction and rebuilding of Nepal, because there are villages and towns like this right across the country and it is going to take years and billions of dollars to rebuild this place.
Ensuring this village gets the funds it needs to rebuild will be down to the local MP, Udaya Rana.
This is slippers, right? But it's here we have the blankets.
I meet him at what I assume must be the local party offices. They're so big, but it's actually his house. The office is next door in a slightly smaller building. Although he's based in the capital, his constituency stretches over a vast swathe of the Kathmandu Valley. Power here is centralised, as there haven't been local elections for many years, and this means there's a turf war among MPs to get the most aid.
I have to fight. You know, the central government is not going to say, OK, you are a nice boy, I'm going to give you stuff. I have to go there, manipulate, and instead of 10 sacks of rice, I have to try and get 12 sacks of rice. The other members of parliament are saying, why are you giving it to him? So it's more than I think most other MPs, I'm told.
He may be getting a good deal for his constituents, but he's worried that the long-term aid needed for the country won't be shared fairly.
The touristic areas around Mount Everest, that is very visible and very attractive to everyone. So a lot of the funds are going to get directed there, but many villages no one's heard of. They are going to get very little. So that must not happen. It has to be spread as even as possible. There may be some MPs who are more active than the other members of parliament, so naturally their constituency is going to get a little more.
Is that a worry that people who are more vocal, more powerful within Parliament, they might get a bigger chunk of the money for their constituents than perhaps another area?
Yes, that's a fear. In a situation like this, every organisation whether it's INGOs, NGOs, individual businessmen, college kids who go there to donate money, it's part of the government machinery. No one is separate. You know, people are saying, oh, the army has come, where's the government? Or the NGO has come, where's the government? So this sort of mechanism, and a lot of these NGOs, INGOs, various social organizations, have been very, very happy to work with us.
Isn't that the government, though, trying to claim benefit for donations that are nothing to do with the government? They're to do with individuals or NGOs.
The government is not trying to take any benefit.
But you said they're part of the government machinery if they're donating in that area. I mean, they're not, are they? They don't want to be part of the government machinery. They want to do it on their own.
No, that they can't. As Chairman Deng said, it doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white. As long as it catches the mice, it's okay.
How do you allay their fears, though, about corruption?
I think there's more corruption outside the government machinery than in the government machinery. So it's just not corruption of the government. It's corruption of the various non-government organization. At the same time, we must not create an atmosphere where the government feels there are other governments also running the show. If that happens, it'll be total chaos.
To try and control this chaos, Nepal's government set up the Prime Minister's Disaster Relief Fund for any new donations. It was worries about this fund that brought me to Nepal in the first place. I was off to meet one of the NGOs who don't want the government to get its hands on their donations.
So these are the tops we have, a little supply now. I mean, we had 3,000 come in day before yesterday, supported by an Indian company that is a connection of a connection of a connection. And they just trusted us to try and distribute this. It was a big problem with getting supplies in Nepal because the government sometimes thinks that we're going to sell it. So then they want a tax on it. And so these tops have come in, and I think by yesterday we already had 2,000 out of the door. And then I think by the end of today this will all be gone.
It had taken me days to meet Raj Guwali. He'd been off delivering supplies to the mountains where his trekking company operates. He also runs an NGO, the Karma Foundation, and has received donations from abroad and within Nepal, which is used to buy supplies and deliver them to areas not reached by the government or international NGOs.
Part of the relief supplies people want to use to their own advantage. So if somebody else has made the effort to bring in the supplies, then they just either hijack it or put it into the government system so that they can be the ones who said, I brought in the aid. You know, it doesn't spread out very well. And this is a big problem already, I mean, with the relief supplies.
Is there a potential for corruption with the amount of money that's going to be coming in?
There always is. It's to do with political cronyism. It's to do with inherent corruption that's always been there. So that part of it will definitely start kicking in. I think initially, I think everybody will be quite sincere because they want to do really good. But then the eyes will be on the money very soon. And then, of course, the potential for things to go wrong will be high. The worry here is that the corruption happens to a scale where things don't happen, you know, and then it gets really, really worrying. Corruption, I think, is there everywhere. We cannot help that.
The British government and people have opened their hearts and wallets to Nepal, donating almost £80 million through the emergency appeal. But even before the earthquake, the UK was the largest national donor to Nepal. The Department for International Development, DFID, had given over £250 million in aid in the last 3 years. So where's it been going? Well, we're going to look at one project which seems particularly relevant after recent events, a £20 million scheme to make Nepal more earthquake resilient.
I've just stopped by one of the big shopping malls in the centre of Kathmandu. It's called United World Trade Centre, and it's been closed down because it's unsafe. You can see up above me there's a massive crack and a bit of masonry that's looking pretty unstable. There's warping in the building. Now, there is a building code in Nepal that was actually developed with British aid. You need government permission to build over a certain height, and certainly something like this, a substantial new building, you need to meet the regulations. But looking at this, it clearly hasn't.
A lot of time and effort has gone into making building regulations tougher, especially in Kathmandu, as globally it's the city most at risk of being hit by an earthquake. It didn't look to me as if these regulations had been well enforced, but I sought advice from someone who knows Nepal well. Kenichi Yokoyama is head of the Asian Development Bank in Nepal, which lends over £100 million to the country every year.
The enforcement, as I understand, is very poor. You know, there is a procedure that the municipal authority must approve all the design documents. And while design document is approved, then the actual construction is not following that design. There are many such circumstances. And also there are some unconfirmed stories, like approval of the design can be bought by paying money. So this is really showing that, you know, the enforcement of the building code is a real requirement now.
This shows how messy aid can be. You can develop the best policies possible, but if they're not enforced, has the money been well spent? We wanted to interview someone from the Department for International Development about this, but they couldn't find anyone to do it, either in Nepal or the UK. They did send us a statement which said they'd been working with the government of Nepal to strengthen legislation and recognised it was a long-term project. The building code is just one part of the UK's resilience project. It also funded the reconstruction or strengthening of over 100 school buildings in eastern Nepal. But when it assessed them, they found they weren't up to scratch and they had to be rectified. But at least this had been spotted. 6,000 schools damaged by the earthquake will need to be rebuilt. We don't know how many of these, if any, were built with international donor money. But we do know it will cost billions to fix them.
The story of development aid in Nepal is billions and billions and billions of dollars pumped in here over half a century. And still Nepal is one of the poorest countries on Earth. I don't think an earthquake is going to change that.
Ben Ayres is from the Z Foundation, started by a group of mountaineers 15 years ago. It works with rural communities in eastern Nepal. I caught up with him at a gathering of volunteers in Kathmandu that Z's mobilised to help with its emergency work. In the longer term, it plans to rebuild over 24 damaged schools.
There's no evidence that Nepal is suddenly going to find a mechanism to efficiently and effectively implement aid projects.
And the schools, why have they been so poorly built?
So many schools fell in Nepal simply as a mechanism of that failed infrastructure here, the failed government. And, you know, the areas where we work and so much of rural Nepal are places that are only accessible by foot. The government budgets are very minimal. Those that are there are allocated based upon patronage networks and corruption. So the money that is allocated for schools isn't enough, and a chunk of that then gets skimmed off. And the communities mean well. A lot of the schools in Nepal were built with local labor and materials by parents who wanted their children to have a place to study. But unfortunately, those schools are not the ones that are built with earthquakes in mind. And, you know, Nepal really averted a tragedy here by the fact that both earthquakes happened on days that school was not in session. We would have been looking at tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of children dying.
The damage from the earthquakes has penetrated into the heart of the government's administration. I'm outside the Prime Minister's office, which is a beautiful four-storey white stuccoed building, dark green window frames, very striking, but it's been abandoned because it's not thought to be safe. There's bits of masonry that have fallen off. The offices have moved across the road to in front of me on the lawn, big green army tents. Not really something to instill confidence into the population, maybe, that at the heart of government, they've had to live in tents as well for the moment.
I am not saying that government is not corrupt, but at least there is a mechanism to punish those who are involved in the corruption.
Even within the government, there's acceptance that it's corrupt. Dr. Govind Pokharel has only recently joined the fold. He's in charge of the Prime Minister's Disaster Relief Fund and Vice Chairman of the National Planning Commission. He understands the desire by donors to bypass the government because of corruption, waste and bureaucracy, but doing so brings other risks.
Who runs NGOs? 70% of the NGOs in Nepal are politically aligned and run by the political leaders and cadres. These people are not elected people. when you want to actually build the nation and build the democracy, you have to use the government system so that in future you force them to become transparent.
What about the role of the big international NGOs? Because lots of money goes to them. How well do you think they perform?
In some cases, 80% money received in the name of the relief goes for the administrative purpose. Some of the development agencies are creating disparity among the societies. A government guy gets $200 per month, whereas you are paying $2,000 per month, a similar capable guy. All capable, good people are being taken by these NGOs, INGOs, in the name of the higher salary. Government is weak. Government is not transparent. We are poor because our system is bad. But to make us better, we need to build the capacity of this system. So I appeal to all those taxpayers, people who are donating this fund, to pressurize development agency to go with the government system and to build the capacity of the government system, not to bypass the government system, which will actually create the danger for the democracy.
OK, this sounds like classic buck-passing, but how well have the big NGOs and the UN agencies performed? Part of the UK government's £20 million earthquake resilience programme in Nepal was carried out by the UN Development Programme, or UNDP. One senior aid insider told me the project was a disaster from start to finish. When the UK government audited the project to see how well its money had been spent, it was damning. It said the UN had poor financial controls, misreporting and recording of payments, and it says it won't make any further payments until sufficient controls are in place, and it makes critical recommendations, which it warns, if not corrected, could affect the UNDP at a global level. I wanted to talk to the Department for International Development about this, but you know the story by now, they couldn't do it. But the UN's top man in Nepal, Jamie McGoldrick, was willing to talk. So how does he explain the UN being rated so badly?
There was a lot of people were audited at that time and not everyone had pass marks. And I think now we have an understanding of where the problems lay and where the issues were. A great deal of scrutiny comes with donor funding these days, and there's a great deal of scrutiny on the scrutiny as well. And some of the things that emerged from some of these have been addressed. I know that those projects which were mentioned in those audits have been fixed according to what was recommended, both from the UNDP side and also the government side and also DFID side.
But that was 3 years in, wasn't it?
It was 3 years in because that's when they did the first audit of any external audit. And at that time, there was also an interim government. So it came at the time when the government partner itself had gone through a process of transition twice.
But this is one project. You know, people will look at this one project and think, if this is the case here, and it's the British government and a UN body, and we're going to have hundreds of millions coming in, there's a worry about, is it going to be properly used?
The conversation we've had with DFID, not just on this project, but in general, I think they believe that we are now a better partner than we were 3 years ago. And I think that because of that, I think there's been a reset in terms of our understanding of how we work these projects.
So there we are. We can be reassured that it's all been fixed. But I decided to take a closer look at the budget, and I've got it in front of me here. It's a five-year project with an initial budget of $15 million. That's £10 million. But here on page 35, there's an international advisor who's going to be paid just over $1 million. And on page 46, another employee paid $900,000. So that means 13% of the budget was going to go on just two employees. Now, the UN told me that this was the original estimate, but actually only one person worked for the full five-year term, so that this $2 million figure was reduced to just $750,000. Now, I'm about to meet Subindra Bogati. He runs an NGO. He's worked as a consultant on previous big aid projects in Nepal. And I want him to have a look at this budget.
No, it doesn't look any detail at all. It looks like fifth grader thinking how much it costs to do this sort of work. There hasn't been that much thought preparing the budget for this.
Subindra Bogati also worked on a £6 million project funded by DFID to reform Nepal's police, which was cancelled before it got off the ground. DFID says this was because it wasn't deemed to be value for money, but Subindra has a different view.
I'm told that the consultant's fee were far higher and Nepal Police didn't like it.
How much were those fees then? What was it that bothered about them?
I got the contract for about 3 years, and I was being paid $300 per day. But for the international consultant, it was up to £1,200 a day.
£1,200?
Yeah.
And the police found out about that, and they didn't like it?
Yeah, they didn't like it, and it got cancelled.
DFID's aid watchdog told us their assessment of consultants found they were value for money, as they tended to stick with the project. For £1,200 a day, so would I. These figures may seem excessive, but I've been told about other international donor projects that were even worse. In one, over £500,000 of aid money was wasted on lavish dinners and overnight stays in £300-a-night hotels. It was justified as it placated the Nepali participants. Jamie McGoldrick at the UN is expecting a surge of consultants providing advice on the rebuilding of roads, hospitals and schools, although he doesn't sound convinced they're such a good thing.
There's been a large development agenda in this country for the last 50, 60 years. We've trained lots of people in this country. There's an industry, I would say, here. The fact you've got 30,000 NGOs speaks for itself. I think we've created all of that. I think there's a very strong case to say that we should be using national consultants before we go international.
Is there a sense that it gives people a bit of security and certainty, donors think, OK, well, if they're coming from abroad, we can trust them a bit more, regardless of the fact it's going to cost them a huge amount?
I don't think it's that. I think it's the expertise part of it. I think that, you know, in some cases, the expertise might not be here on technical things. I know that, for example, in the UN, we always look to try and get national consultants before we go international, because it's cheaper. And often these local consultants end up coming to work for the UN on that project. So, I mean, these things happen. But international consultants, I suspect now with this changing circumstance, there'll be a wave that will come in, and whether it's a helpful wave remains to be seen.
The issue of the effectiveness of aid isn't just one for the UK. The earthquake has exposed potential problems in other projects funded by international donors. I've been told about damage at Nepal's biggest library, Tribhuvan University, on the outskirts of Kathmandu. Its extension had been built with money from the World Bank. The library had been closed for safety reasons, but Janardhan Dungana, who's in charge, agreed to let me in.
All we were afraid. Most of the racks fell down, books were scattered, and women were weeping. And they are very afraid. Psychologically, they are not prepared to enter in the building, so we decided just to close it.
So we've just come up to the first floor. Downstairs, you can see books have been shaken, but up here, you can see really big damage. You can see this massive crack running along the beam, and it's not connected to the wall, is it?
Yeah.
I've come back out of the university library now into a safer environment, and what's striking inside there is that this new section of the library funded by the World Bank, pretty intact, it looks fairly safe. But at the point where it joins this old annex, which is about 20 years old, it really looks pretty unsafe. I can just see in front of me a huge crack where the old and new buildings join together. And what's strange is you would invest all of this money in a new building, but wouldn't actually look maybe to correct or assess the annex, which is also built with donor money. It just doesn't seem to be really very joined up thinking.
Well, this is a website that we built very recently after the earthquake that actually takes into account the total amount of money that's coming to Nepal, both from international sources and national sources.
Because what in a small office looking out over a stormy Kathmandu, Bibhushan Bista, an IT entrepreneur, shows me the website he set up to try and track the money coming in from different groups, governments and individuals. Bibhushan leads a small team of software developers working full-time to monitor the aid donated to Nepal. So far, they've tracked £500 million coming in, and they want to see where it goes.
Basically, if we want to avoid the situation that we've been reading about Haiti, we need to know what we are entitled for, and we need to know what we need to do in terms of like monitoring the rebuilding work. That's why it has to start somewhere. And we thought, let's do it ourselves. It's also about equipping our government system and other actors saying, this is how transparency actually can help your work. And we just do not want to push them against the wall. Rather, it's about like we'll help you be more transparent and, you know, we'll help you be more effective in terms of rebuilding and your project works.
You mentioned Haiti and that that was one of the things that had motivated you. What was it about the Haiti disaster that made
I did not have my first-hand experience, of course, but I read it that for the Haiti disaster, they received close to $9 billion US dollars, and 80% of that was not actually spent in rebuilding. And we do not want that to happen in Nepal, and that is our primary thrust behind starting this kind of initiative.
Is this site an attempt to try and stop corruption as well, to make sure you know where the money's going?
Oh, yes. You know, let's say, for example, if we are able to track X amount of money is being distributed by chief district officer in one of the districts, and if we are able to keep a track of that, then people would keep an eye on that person who is spending that money. And so, in a way, indirectly, we are trying to address corruption as well. But as I said earlier, we're not going with transparency as something against them. You know, we're saying that we'll help you do it together.
Nepal needs all the help it can get. When we left, any open space was filled by people too scared to return to their homes, and they have no idea when they'll get the money to rebuild them. It will need a massive injection of new funds, far more than has already been given. Ben Ayres from the NGO The Z Foundation says ensuring it's used effectively will require a fundamental change in the way that aid is delivered here.
To minimize corruption and so forth in Nepal, there really does need to be a movement on behalf of donors. And the attitudes need to change on part of the people who are writing the checks. It does have to start with donors that are willing to support projects and organizations that take a bit more of a grassroots and a slower approach. And then I think on the ground, there does need to be a process of communities as well holding the government and the development agencies accountable for the work that they are doing on their behalf. A tool that we found is very powerful at Z is we hang these public audit banners. Basically, we display our project budgets publicly at the work site. So every rupee that is spent on a project, the whole community can see and watch as it comes in and goes out. And that allows the community to understand that there hasn't been any corruption, and those who have bad ideas basically have to face the wrath of their community. It's not a perfect system, but it does get people engaged and empowered to check up on things. Very theoretical, it's very pie in the sky, but that's where you need to start.
The UK government and other donors do have systems in place to track their money, which is needed more than ever in Nepal. But the country also needs more people like Bibhushan on the ground following the money to ensure the continued generosity and support from the UK reach the people who need it most.
The presenter was Simon Cox, the producer, Ben Crichton.